Good evening, friends. Franz Weinschenk here, once again welcoming you to Valley Writers Read, where all the writers that read their stories for us either have in the past or currently reside right here in Central California. And of course, tonight is no exception. We're delighted to present Reedley resident Hope Knisley reading a memoir of hers entitled Morning in America. Here she is, Hope Knisley, Morning in America.
Morning in America. About the same time that my landlady in Oakland was released from prison for burning down another one of her apartment buildings, I began to work at a shelter for homeless women and children. The two events in parallel achieved quite a cumulative effect in my life. Whatever drama my friends and I endured at our apartment with our psycho landlady, it was easily eclipsed by my nightlife at the shelter by the San Francisco Bay. Armed with high ideals, a relatively compassionate heart, and, most importantly, a need for a job, I began to work in what turned out to be one of the most difficult jobs ever. My high ideals were quickly tempered by this new experience. It was a job that messed with my mind, my self-perception, and my worldview. I soon learned that people didn't always like me, despite my best efforts. I had to be much more aggressive than I ever wanted to be. I found out that compassion isn't enough and that dreams of justice cannot always be realized. Working at the shelter even turned me into a temporary smoker. Becoming an intake counselor in a homeless shelter wasn't exactly what I had planned. True, in some distant past, my high school days, I had said that I wanted to be a social worker, but I abandoned that goal and finally acknowledged that I really did not want to work with people, as I had told my high school guidance counselor. My choices didn't seem infinite at the time. In my community, it was only marginally acceptable to go to college, but the taboo could be lifted for a service profession. It was acceptable to think of becoming a nurse, a teacher, or a social worker. I finally admitted that I'd rather study history. After college, when I moved to Oakland, one of my first short-lived jobs was typing scientific reports for a translator, a woman who was fluent in Hindi, Mandarin, English, German, French, and Spanish. She was a funny, round little woman who had been born and raised in Shanghai during the peaceful takeover by the People's Liberation Army. Her stories, when I could keep up with her narrative, were wild and oddly devoid of emotion as she told me about her family's move out of her childhood home in Shanghai. While working with her, I kept looking for something better, something that would give me more than a paycheck and interesting stories. I wanted meaning and purpose. This was in the period that President Reagan declared to be Morning in America. The decade had begun with double-digit inflation, and it was to end with the fall of the Berlin Wall. It included a war on drugs, the emergence of crack babies, and the year of the yuppie. It spawned aid concerts such as Live Aid and Farm Aid, which brought out celebrities to urge us to sing We Are the World. We repeated disparate slogans from Where's the Beef? To Just Say No? To Shop Till You Drop. Depending upon our worldview or stage in life, our bumper stickers read Baby on Board, Save Mona Lake, The Christian Right is Neither, or No Contra Aid. The decade brought us Donald Trump, Ivan Boesky, Oliver North, and Leona Helmsley. But we also had Mitch Snyder and Carol Fennelly to admire. I had been reading about Mitch and his work for the homeless in Washington, D.C., when a friend at Catholic Social Services called to tell me they were opening a shelter for homeless women and children in a nearby city. I applied and got the job with no experience or understanding of what was to come, and that was how I found myself working the overnight shift at a temporary shelter for little pay and with short-term prospects. The shelter only had funding for 3 months of the Bay Area's rainy weather. My lack of experience and my idealism was, I suppose, a hidden blessing. I might have run the other way if I'd have known. In any case, there I was working with a Catholic parish on the staff of a shelter for homeless women and children. This was morning in America on the ground.
You ain't got no job, ain't got no smoke, ain't got a car, this life's a joke. Living on the skids.
When we opened the doors of St. Joseph's Emergency Winter Shelter for Women and Children, the first family waiting on the doorsteps was Sandra's. Sandra pushed her way in out of the cold with confident obliviousness to anyone else. Right behind her came her two daughters in their late teens, one carrying a baby. There's only one way to say it. Sandra was large and loud. There was no mistaking her voice or ignoring her presence. She lumbered into the shelter and filled the place in every way imaginable. Dahlia, the younger daughter, was also a formidable presence. Damaris was the polar opposite of her mother and sister in both size and aura. Damaris's newborn daughter, Jayla, was 2 months old, and she weighed barely 7 pounds. Sandra and Dahlia would sign in each night and then dump their goods on their cots. They displayed their wares and joked loudly. They were the first in line for food and the last to go to bed. They didn't just live at the shelter, they dominated it. Damaris spent her evenings in the corner rocking Jayla in a hickory rocker that a St. Joseph parishioner had donated especially for her. Something about my name struck Dahlia funny. What got into your mama to name you Hope? She would ask. In turn, I would comment about being named for a flower. Then she'd snort, "A flower's better than Hope. Who has Hope?" Often she would follow me around the shelter murmuring my name over and over. "Hope, Hope, Hope. Hope," she would repeat, and when I asked her to stop, she found that even funnier than my name. When not with her mother and sister, Damaris talked quietly about finishing high school, perhaps going to college. She was interested in strange facts in history, and she liked reading. She had just finished The Color Purple, and she told me how much she loved Anne of Green Gables when she was younger. "Did you know," Damaris asked me one night, "that Hitler's mother wanted an abortion and her doctor talked her out of it? Just think how different things might have been if she had done what she wanted." Damaris even thought about writing some stories herself, but she didn't want to use the notebooks that her mother and Dahlia stole from the drugstore. Humiliated by the antics of her family, Damaris had little energy or knowledge of how to break the ties and move out on her own. Her family was all she had, but now, with a baby daughter, she was just beginning to look at things in a new light, with renewed hope that she might do something else. In the 2 years that I worked at St. Joe's, I saw Sandra and Dahlia several more times, but I never saw Damaris again. They shrugged disinterestedly when I asked about Damaris. The last time they came, Sandra responded to my question with, "Damaris who?" If ever there was a woman who fit the image of the welfare queen, it was Sandra. Dahlia was only a decade or two behind her mother in both experience and effort. Neither one drove the requisite Cadillac or had an income of $150,000. Those eyebrow-raising details were President Reagan's embellishment. From his first mention of the welfare queen in the 1976 primary race, Reagan clung to his story, reviving it with renewed fervor during his presidency. The image struck a nerve in the post-civil rights, middle-class white America, and the icon fixed itself in the collective imagination. Welfare and welfare fraud had long been viewed as a minority issue. With Reagan's words, the target became both race and gender specific. The media could not locate and verify this black woman on welfare with numerous wigs, a myriad of identities, too many children, and a Cadillac. Even so, Reagan's anecdote was sufficient. And most Americans did not like this person who could live so high while ignoring our values and our work ethic. With public support, welfare was cut, housing assistance reduced. Reagan appointed developers and bankers to sit on the National Task Force on Housing. In the preceding decades, there was an increasing deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill. With many causes, homelessness was clearly on the rise. On Good Morning America, Reagan told us that the homeless were homeless by choice. Places like St. Joe's were springing up everywhere in an effort to get people off the streets. Sandra and Dahlia left a wake of debris in their path across the East Bay. They didn't have a six-figure income, but they had a Santa Claus-sized garbage bag filled with high-end clothes, shoes, food, purses, calculators, Tylenol, and you name it. En masse, the neighborhood around St. Joseph's shelter descended on the parish office to register its anger and disgust. Within a day of our opening and the arrival of Sandra, the grocery store, drugstore, and public library all reported on Sandra and Dahlia's swath of shoplifting and general destruction. St. Joe's ongoing existence was at risk. We immediately implemented a new rule. Anything that a client brought into the shelter must have an accompanying receipt. Sandra was one of the long-term homeless, a woman who had figured out how to work a system that had screwed her. With her blatant disregard of society's values and her rough manner, her very presence proved and disproved points on all sides of the issue. Sandra led my first class in Homelessness 101. My supervisor and co-workers were every bit as interesting as our clients. There were not many of us. David was the parish deacon, the one who directed the shelter from afar, worked with the financial end of the endeavor, and popped in from time to time to see how things were going. He had a jolly demeanor and a brusque manner. Aaron was the hands-on director who had been helping launch shelters for at least a decade, even though he was just past 30. A descendant of Hawaiian royalty, he taught us phrases in Hawaiian, played his ukulele for the children, and watched out for the staff as well as for the clients. When I had a cyst removed from the top of my head, his eagle eyes noticed immediately, and he asked several times how I got those stitches. He was as vigilant in his efforts to determine the believability of my story as he was with any of the clients. He had adapted to the milieu of the shelter life such that he saw everyone as a potential victim of abuse. Besides myself, there were two other intake counselors, Leah and Sharon. Leah had spent the previous several years running from her own batterer. With an MSW and her experience as a battered woman, she was the most knowledgeable and also the most volatile. She was on edge and ever vigilant for the appearance of her former husband. This was the man who had followed her from one side of the United States to the other, forcing her and her teenage daughter into a nomadic life. The Bay Area was their fifth location since leaving him. Leah took her nervous alertness out on the other intake counselors. In retrospect, it is easy to recognize post-traumatic stress disorder, but the terminology was less than a decade old at the time. Sharon was an activist working on two key peace and justice issues, advocacy for homeless women and protests of nuclear testing. She spent much of her off time sitting at the gate to the Nevada test site. As long as she was on staff, I was safe from Leah because Sharon was the butt of Leah's anger and hatred. After Leah managed to drive Sharon out, she unleashed her anger on me. I was an easy target, an idealistic Midwestern transplant who made lots of errors in judgment. Why she had not chosen me first over Sharon is still a mystery. Perhaps she thought I might be more malleable, more open to her efforts to teach and mold. Our shelter was not specifically for battered women, but over time we saw many who were homeless because they were fleeing an abuser. Shelters for victims of domestic violence were a relatively recent phenomenon, and they were underfunded in the face of growing demand. Leah, of course, recognized abuse the most readily of the three of us. On more than one occasion, we admitted a battered woman who could not find an opening at a hidden shelter. We accepted each one with fear and trepidation. Only once did the batterer also come to the door in search of his victim, but the likelihood was an ever-present fear. There was so much to learn at the shelter and so little preparation. On-the-job training was good only in that it provided real-life examples of textbook knowledge. The constant flow of people meant that we had to make many split-second decisions. Who should be refused admittance? Who should be evicted? Or when to call Child Protective Services? At first, it wasn't easy to differentiate between a behavior that was a drug reaction and one that indicated mental illness. The third possibility was that the behavior was street-induced idiosyncrasy emanating from the stress of raising children without a roof or daily food. Most of the time, I was sure I was wrong. In that one assumption, I was usually right. She walked through the door, down the hall, toward the kitchen-turned office where I awaited our clients each evening. Her long, tangled black hair framed a leathery brown face, but how much was dirt and what was merely skin toughened by life in the open air was anyone's best guess. Eyes darting from side to side, she surveyed the hallway, the people who were milling around waiting for dinner, and finally, me. Involuntarily, I almost took a step backwards. The look she projected was concentrated, forceful, almost feral. Looking into her filmy eyes and filthy face, I swallowed my uneasiness and began the intake process. Her name was Linda, but beyond that, I could get very little information. I wasn't sure how to assess her needs or provide referrals. The intake interview was often a game of reading between the lines and deciphering body language or state of the eyes. With Linda, it was an absolute guessing game. Her race, ethnicity, reasons for being homeless, SSI or income information, all of it was a lost cause. Even in my experience and naivete, I knew that I might be risking a lot, even my job, if I allowed her to stay for the night, but I couldn't tell her to leave either. As a temporary shelter, we had no bathing facilities. I gave her a washcloth and towel and showed her the bathroom. All evening, Linda sat in the hallway, rocking back and forth on a creaking folding chair, muttering indecipherably. The other residents kept their distance. Linda's words, when I could catch them, were random and intriguing, but without context or meaning. Alabaster. Murky. Never. Cake. Her mumbling with its strange sequence of words continued, but conversation was impossible. Her eyes rarely met mine, and when they did, her gaze revealed no indication that she saw me. I could have been gawking into the eyes of a rainbow trout for all the response and recognition that I was garnering. The other women complained bitterly, even the ones without children who usually didn't care quite so much. Linda paced the hallway, seldom laid down, barely even sat on the edge of her cot. I told her the rules about lights out and quiet time. She never acknowledged my words, and her muttering continued to flow. I did not sleep much that night. In one way, Linda inspired less fear than most. A mother with several children could look like any of us. Linda could not. Linda just looked crazy. The desire not to be near her was not fear, but revulsion. Even the children, normally uninhibited and open to anyone, walked the other way. But she certainly didn't make anyone feel that this could be us. Linda sat alone, and that was how she seemed to want it to remain. Shelter activity swirled around her with its normal chaos. She never noticed. Several days later, Linda solved the problem of what to do with her in the shelter. She simply evicted herself and left as quickly as she had arrived, without referrals for mental health care, without assistance in obtaining another shelter. At 10:30 on her last night, she came to the desk and stood staring. Only she wasn't glaring at me. She was glowering at her image in the mirror behind me. "You," she thundered, "have been very bad." She stomped her foot to emphasize the point. "You cannot live with civilized people. There are good people here, and small children, too." Her brief, choppy speech was as much coherence as I had heard from her. The next thing I knew, she fixed her crooked grin on me, swiped her hair behind her ear, and took hold of her left sleeve with her right hand, saying, "Would you like me to remove her for you?" Without waiting for an answer, she escorted herself down the hall and out the back door. She left behind a crumpled napkin on the desk for me, a napkin with a drawing of a wild-haired woman sitting at a desk with a straight-laced figure that was, obviously, me. One Sunday morning a month later, when I got off work, my friend Doug and I walked up Telegraph Avenue on our way to Cafe Mediterranean. We carried our Oakland Tribune and bought a San Francisco Chronicle. Sipping our coffee, awaiting our pancakes and French toast, and soaking up the early spring sunshine, we handed the various sections of the newspaper back and forth. When I finally reached the arts and leisure section, I stared in disbelief. There, in the bottom right corner, were two paintings of a sad-looking woman who could have hailed from Picasso's Blue Period. A brief article described a homeless woman whose oil paintings were sweeping the art scene of San Francisco. The article identified this particular artist, recognizable by her self-portrait, as Rose Linda. The dreamy, surreal quality of the painting could not hide the artist's identity. It was Linda from the shelter, the woman who had evicted herself. The words of the article were almost as unbelievable and incoherent as Linda's own words that she muttered in the darkened halls of St. Joe's. Over the years, I have searched for her name and her work, but she has disappeared. Perhaps there is a painting hanging in a gallery somewhere, but if so, I have not found it. Not even Google, our 21st century find-everything tool, has led me to further information. Rose Linda has vanished, and all I have is a newspaper clipping with which to remember her. When Patricia arrived with her five quiet, delightful, and obedient daughters, I was drawn to her and her resolute nature and her desire to make a life for her girls, even in the shelter chaos. She tended them lovingly and spoke as one with some education. She had been a legal assistant for a lawyer, but lost her job when he had been indicted for non-payment of taxes. Before she could get another job, she was evicted from her apartment, putting the six of them on the streets. The daughters ranged in age from 4 to 15, and they all watched out for each other while they kept up with their homework. There was no fighting among this bunch, no back talk to their mother. Every resident had 4 weeks to stay at the shelter, and if at that time they were on track by shelter standards, we granted them an additional 2 weeks. During their residency, they received the appropriate referrals and free bus passes to get to appointments. Patricia appeared to be the most likely to succeed, the first one who would be able to get back on her feet and out of the cycle of poverty and homelessness. She dutifully went to every appointment to keep up her AFDC payments, worked on her resume, and came home to the shelter to encourage her daughters that they would have a home again soon. They followed the rules and kept their bedroom area neat and tidy. She was the antithesis of the Reagan welfare queen. Her daughters did not fit the identity of poorly behaving, underachieving kids on the street. One evening, the five daughters, led by Keisha, the 15-year-old, filed in the door and to my desk to sign in for the night. I assumed that Patricia was just a few steps behind them. 15 minutes later, it occurred to me that I had not yet seen her, and I went in search of Keisha to ask where her mother was. "I don't know," Keisha answered my query. "I haven't seen Mama all day. She was going to the drugstore for some NyQuil for baby, and she didn't come back to the park where we were waiting." My questions elicited nothing more from the girls. They watched Keisha and let her do all of the talking. Not one of the five acted like this was out of the ordinary or appeared to be frightened, but I didn't catch that until later. The shelter rule was that no child was to be admitted without their mother, but these were Patricia's girls. I couldn't send Patricia's girls into the cold, not even if it meant the warm car of a CPS worker. Surely Patricia would be here soon. But Patricia didn't come. Throughout the night, I considered the options but remained worried and perplexed, certain only that Patricia would be back for her girls and that all would be well. There would be a reasonable explanation. The wait was agonizing. It was after midnight before I received a phone call from the police stating that Patricia was in the hospital. Someone had found her tied in a tree in a park in the Oakland Hills. She was dehydrated, badly bruised, and had multiple serious lacerations. Someone would bring her to the shelter the following evening. That was all the information they could provide. The next morning, I handed the girls their daily bus passes along with an extra hug. Tonight, they would be back together in the shelter, back on the road towards self-sufficiency, the one that led to a job and an apartment. I was far too distressed and worried to go home and sleep for the morning. Instead, I got off BART at Lake Merritt and wandered around the gardens on the roof of the Oakland Museum. When I got to the shelter that night, Aaron and Leah were both there. Leah's pursed lips indicated trouble. "What the hell were you thinking by not calling CPS last night to get Patricia's daughters?" she demanded. Aaron's approach was kinder. "Do you understand what happened?" he asked me. He sent Leah off to finish the evening intakes that would have been mine to do. He explained that it was not a random act of violence that left Patricia tied to a tree in a park. She often left her daughters to go off with strange men, this time with two strange men. What began as a mutual tryst ended in a serious assault. So what did I know? I had no training, and I had lived a life where what you saw was, for the most part, what was true. In the shelter, truth took on a whole new dimension. Truth was survival, and survival might require distortions of truth and alterations of fact. I never got used to the constant need to separate fact from fiction. Sometimes it didn't matter. More often it did. There was always, or so it seemed to me, such a fine line between truth and fabrication, and I wanted to believe people. Nights spent worrying over what this drug addict might do, or whether that mother was abusing her kid, moments of frustration over who had stolen the bus passes, helped eliminate some of my naivete. When 3-year-old Jasmine came to the shelter with a clear hand imprint on her face, it was easy enough to determine the course of action, no matter what her mother reported. But when someone's children were running amok through the shelter, while the attempts of their mother, which seemed like honest efforts to me, brought no positive changes to behavior, did she just need a referral to parenting classes, or was it to the point where I had to evict them? And the shadow hanging over all my decisions was the knowledge that as a childless woman with a place to call home, what did I know about the travails of child-rearing without the benefit of 4 comforting walls and 3 square meals a day? As for Patricia, I still found it hard to accept that she brought this on herself. In the bigger picture, however, I was not attempting to build long-term relationships with anyone so I could move on and leave it behind. Patricia's daughters went into foster care and Patricia went into drug rehab. I missed them, but there were other clients coming and other decisions to make. The crack epidemic, which was on the minds of most Americans at the time, was in full swing. In retrospect, the epidemic was partially manufactured by the media, in part due to the racial makeup of its primary users. We saw some crack users at the shelter. More frightening than crack, however, was the effect of PCP, the drug with more white users and less media coverage. The first time I saw it, I didn't recognize it. All I knew was that there was a wild-eyed woman standing in the shelter doorway along with her 4 daughters. They had been at the shelter a week already. Her husband slept in the car with their 1 son. The son was over 13 and too old to be admitted to the shelter. Tonight the husband walked her to the door, reluctant to leave her side. I let her in despite a clear sense that something wasn't right. Carol's eyes were taking in everything down the shelter hallway, moving with unusual speed from object to person all around the place. Her daughters refused to leave her side. One of them told me that their dad had given them strict instructions to take care of her. What he thought they could do, I'll never know. Against shelter policy, he stood in the doorway trying to get my attention, hoping for permission to come in. When I insisted that he leave, he left reluctantly. In the end, Carol didn't do much more than stay awake all night and try to maintain intense conversations on random topics. She did not sleep. After lights out, she paced the hallway, occasionally sitting on her bed briefly. Her daughters also refused to sleep. Her most extreme act was to stand on a chair and sing a made-up song about flying. She got down when I asked her to, but she kept swinging chairs above her head while singing other strange lyrics. At one point, she tried to lift Julia, another client who was a bit overweight. It almost started a fistfight, but Julia maintained her best judgment, recognized the futility of any response, and left the room to calm down. "That is one messed-up white bitch," Julia told me in the kitchen. I wrote my report and, of course, got chewed out by Leah the next night. This one, I'll admit, was understandable. If it hadn't been for the four daughters, I would have never let her stay. It strained my best judgment and goodwill to think about throwing the children into the streets, but I knew it should have been done. When Leah yelled her perennial question at me, "What the hell were you thinking?" the question had an edge of unreality and even stupidity, no matter how warranted it was. We officially banished Carol from the shelter for at least 6 months, and Aaron made me tell her. Her husband stormed around the shelter after I barred her entrance. I never liked calling the police, but this was one time when I did it without hesitation. Life with Leah continued to be problematic. She would come in smiling and chummy one night, and the next she would be filled with anger over one of my mistakes. She bent policy as she saw fit, then castigated me for not understanding the rules. At first, I made the mistaken assumption that she always made the right decision. It wasn't long before she began a relationship with Aaron, and he spent his time trying to keep everyone calm and happy. The weekend when Leah thought her former abuser had found her once again, we all rallied around her and stood ready to call the police if necessary. One evening they called before I left home for the night shift and asked me to stop at the hospital to pick up an 18-year-old on the verge of being discharged. Monica had attempted suicide to get away from her mother and boyfriend. She'd spent most of her childhood in serious danger from both of them. This was her way out. Monica was not very talkative, but she came with me willingly, and her body language did not exude anger or belligerence. I did her intake and gave her a bed in the singles room. Around midnight, Monica came to the desk and asked to sit with me for a while. She was scared, she told me, scared and a bit frustrated. "Sometimes my therapist lets me tear newspapers into strips," she told me. "It helps relieve some pressure inside me, and my pressure is up to here." Monica gestured to her throat. "Well," I told her, "I'll see what I can find. I think we have some newspapers back here." I handed her the day's issue of the Oakland Tribune and sat back. She tore them with relish, and then together we cleaned up the mess. "Okay," she told me, "I think I can sleep now." She returned to her cot, and I wrote up the episode in the night notes. I didn't even make it through sleep at home the next morning. Leah called and was enraged with me for letting Monica tear the paper. "Of all the stupid things you've done, that was the stupidest," she hurled at me through the phone. "You aren't a therapist. Who knows what might have happened when Monica unleashed her anger? You wouldn't have been able to handle it if it had gone wrong." I hadn't seen it as therapy, only as a release valve instigated by Monica herself. I assured Leah that I had learned something, and life at the shelter went back to not exactly normal, but to the usual routine. Other clients came and went. Some came and went several times. Like any encounter with other people, I loved some, tolerated some, despised others. The aging lesbian who looked like a man became a good friend. I met her son and granddaughter, who were not homeless, and we shared cups of coffee at the local women's bookstore. As I learned to get tough with problem clients, she called me Butch, and we talked long into the night while she was at St. Joe's. There were some surprises, such as the business executive who came to the shelter in a suit and carrying a briefcase. Unemployed and having lost all savings, she was one of the temporary ones. She spent more time going to job interviews than most of the women, and within a month she found one. Then it was only a matter of finding an apartment. She stayed a little longer than most as she got back on her feet. True success stories were not often this forthcoming. Then there was a large black woman who had two daughters and one son. Ebony and Ivory were both as blue-black as she was, while little Jimmy was the palest little blonde boy with ice-blue eyes I have ever seen. He called her Mommy. Melinda's only explanation was, "This is my brother's boy." I had the painful task of turning away the woman whose only problem was that she had a 14-year-old son and no one to care for him. Being over 13, we couldn't admit him to a women's shelter, and she had to find other options. Other options, meaning the streets. Despite all my efforts, I could not find an opening for them that night in any other shelter up and down the East Bay. I listened to the residents share tips with each other about where to get cheap or free kids' shoes and how to navigate the lines at the AFDC office. I watched while they gave the neediest among them a favorite blouse or a dollar for coffee later in the day and help each other get to the bus on time. I watched fleeting mini-communities build and diminish as residents arrived and departed each week. I also saw how rapidly the delicate bonds of affinity faded when the same people who watched out for each other turned on each other in the heat of the night. We sang Mele Kalikimaka while we decorated a Christmas tree. We doled out the daily bus passes, and we ate our evening goulash and morning Cheerios together. The staff worked without pay for several weeks when the funding dried up and the parish had to find more. We rejoiced when our three-month shelter turned into a permanent one. Everyone was constantly exhausted and on the verge of burnout, while we struggled to maintain our humanity in the face of exceeding odds. This was truly the hardest job I ever loved, and I would never do it again. Stories have a strange way of twisting around and conflating time. Sometimes we find the most unexpected connections in what we do. A few years after I left the shelter and after grad school, my husband and I decided to have children. I had never been plagued with a biological clock that ticked down my childbearing minutes. Instead, my husband and I chose to adopt two children, brother and sister, who had spent much of their lives in the foster care system. They were 8 and 10 at the time. Reading through my children's social service files was an experience in deja vu. From home to shelter to foster care and back home again, their life story as laid out in caseworker notes was painful and erratic. When I got to the part where they had lived in a homeless shelter with their mother, I stopped. I could hardly breathe, let alone read further. This was straight out of my own past, but from the other side of the fence. The uncanny part was that it was describing an incident that occurred at the exact time when I was working at the shelter on the opposite coast. The file noted that they, along with their mother, had been evicted by the shelter because, quote, "this mother does not appear capable of controlling her children. Furthermore," the caseworker's handwriting scrawled its way contemptuously across the page, "it appears that this is not the first time it happened. This shelter has refused to let them back in unless she agrees to parenting classes." As I sit in that stifling little cubicle in the blocky, brick, depressing social services building, I look up to see the cherry blossoms outside the window. The caseworker pokes her head in to remind me that I don't have much more time. I nod to her and close my eyes. In my mind, I see my two children at the tender young ages of 2 and 4. I picture them walking into St. Joseph's Shelter for Homeless Women and Children. I observe while they, along with their mother, walk down the long hallway toward the intake desk, toward me. I listen in on the conversation while I ask their mother the usual intake questions. All the while, her children are cavorting wildly around the desk, completely out of control, and making a mess of papers, trash can, and the cups on the counter. With each crash of something else falling, I feel the pain all over again as I try to figure out the best move to make, second-guessing myself. But now it isn't about me anymore. It is about my children. I see two smiling, resilient, but damaged children who have lived through life's chaos and spent time in a homeless shelter, and now the children are part of me and not just those of some nameless woman on the other side of the desk. All I can do is hold my breath and wait for the grip to relax its hold on my chest.
That was Hope Knisley reading Morning in America, and as we heard, It's a memoir of all the sometimes tragic, sometimes dangerous, sometimes not understandable, sometimes even funny experiences Hope went through as an intake receptionist at St. Joseph's Emergency Shelter for Women and Children in Oakland. She meets, directs, supervises, counsels, and socializes with a broad variety of women and their children for whom the shelter seems to be the last possible place for some kind of survival. As she describes it, the atmosphere was usually chaotic. She had to deal with women of all races, ethnicities, and sexual orientations, and she was often amazed about how wrong her first impressions of these clients turn out to be, like the friendly, live-by-the-rules lady who came to live there with her children, who, from all appearances, seemed to be so secure and anchored, but turned out to be a severe narcotics addict. And then there was the woman who acted totally strange, utterly otherworldly, who it was later discovered was a famous artist. And at the end of her memoir, Hope sums up her experiences this way. "This was truly the hardest job I ever loved, and I would never do it again." Thanks, Hope Knisely, for the anecdotes, the information, and the insights of what it was like working in a place like that. Friends, Hope Knisely currently lives in Reedley. We've had her on numerous times, and we're always taken by her very honest, sincere, and factual writing. Recently, a story of hers entitled "The Black Box" was published in the Pacific Journal. We certainly hope she's working on some more stories for us for next year. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Next week, I'll be reading a story of mine. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.